Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the December Afghanistan Review conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity for questions and comments. Instructions will be given at that time. I would now like to turn the conference call over to our host, Meghan Ortegas, Director of Communication at ISW. Meghan?
Hi, thank you, Krista. Thank you, everyone, for joining the call today. As Krista said, my name is Meghan Ortegas with the Institute for the Study of War. We're going to keep this conference call to an hour, and we're going to try to keep it on military time here. So I appreciate it when everyone has a time for questions and answers, that you please keep your questions brief. In addition to having a conference call, we also have an interactive web portion of this conference call. I hope you all got the email. If not, if you're in front of your computer, please log on to www.accuconference.com. That's accuconference.com. You're going to click Join a Meeting, and you'll see that in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage by the flag. And once you click Join a Meeting, you're going to enter our participant conference call number and the participant code in order to see the PowerPoint presentation that we have for you today. All right. In addition to having our interactive conference call, we're going to have a presentation first by Carl Forsberg. Carl is an Afghanistan scholar here at the Institute for the Study of War. If you had not had a chance to download it, I encourage you to go to understandingwar.org today and download his new report that was released this week. It's called Counterinsurgency in Kandahar, Evaluating the 2010 Humkari Campaign. Carl was invited to Afghanistan in July 2010 to join a team conducting research for General Dave Petraeus following his assumption of command. In addition to this report on Kandahar, Carl has also authored two prior reports, The Taliban's Campaign for Kandahar and Politics and Power in Kandahar. He has presented his findings in congressional testimony, at a weekly Pentagon forum, and, of course, in the media. For those members of the media and press on the call, please note that this call is on the record, and we're happy to set up personal interviews with both of our presenters if you'd like to take some more time with them. Our second presenter will be Jeffrey Jessler. Jeff is an Afghanistan scholar as well here at ISW, and his new report on Helmand, entitled Counterinsurgency in Helmand, Progress and Remaining Challenges, will be released on Monday of next week. So I encourage everyone to keep an eye out for that and visit our website Monday, Tuesday of next week to download the report. Jeff was also part of the team conducting research for General Petraeus in Afghanistan this summer. His prior report on Helmand is Securing Helmand, Understanding and Responding to the Enemy. He has drawn praise from the Marine Corps intelligence community for his work on the enemy network in southern Afghanistan. And in addition, he has been invited to Camp Lejeune on several occasions to brief Marine battalions prior to their deployment to Afghanistan. Jeff is also available for media interviews for those members of the press on the call who would like to take more time with him after. All right, and one last final bit of shameless self-promotion. Dr. Kimberly Kagan, who is the president of the Institute for the Study of War, has an op-ed today. It's co-authored with her husband, Fred Kagan, and it's in the Washington Post. Again, you can find that on the homepage of our website or visit the Washington Post to read their op-ed on the Afghanistan Review. It's a great read. I'm biased, obviously, but I think it's really important for everyone to take a look at that, and it's a short op-ed, so you can get through it quickly. All right, I am going to turn the call over to Carl Forsberg, who's going to present his findings on Kandahar.
Thank you, Meghan. As Meghan said, I'm Carl Forsberg, and talking about Kandahar this morning. The long and short of what's happened in Kandahar is the coalition has reversed momentum in Kandahar during the course of the last 6 months. And to start with the importance of Kandahar, it's true that some people say that the Taliban may have simply moved some of their forces to other areas of the country after the operations in southern Afghanistan this summer. But I think the thing to note here is that there's some terrain which is much more important than other terrain in Afghanistan, and Kandahar has strategic value that is probably greater than that of any other province in the country. Kandahar was the home of the Durrani monarchy. It's the home of the Karzai family. It's in many ways the political and spiritual home of southern Afghanistan, and of course it was also the home of the Taliban movement, Most of the Taliban senior leadership came from Kandahar, and Kandahar was the de facto capital in the 1990s. So the Taliban has made retaking Kandahar a chief objective, and psychologically in Afghanistan, as long as the Karzai government can hold Kandahar, it deals a significant blow to the Taliban's momentum and to their image as a viable alternative to the Afghan government. So Kandahar really is key. The Taliban started their campaign to retake Kandahar within a year or so after 2001. They began to reconstitute and slowly increased their influence in the province. ISAF conducted a number of clearing operations, sweeping through some of the key terrain in Kandahar, but was never able to fundamentally dislodge the Taliban. Now, if we can go to the next slide. There are a few critical districts around Kandahar city. To the south and north of Kandahar, you've got desert and mountains, fairly barren terrain. But around Kandahar city itself, you have several very fertile districts. They're densely cultivated, large population centers, and these are Argandab, Zari, Panjwe, and Dun districts. And these are the districts the Taliban targeted from 2003 to 2009. These are the districts in which they gradually rebuilt control. By 2009, they more or less controlled large parts of Argandab, Zari, and Panjwe. From these districts, they ran very complex attack networks, had a very sophisticated infrastructure, which included weapon stockpiles, safe houses, fortified bunkers, some of them very complex. They also ran homemade explosives production facilities and IED factories. They were able to infiltrate Kandahar City, control much of the population. They ran shadow courts throughout Kandahar, most of them based in Zari, Panjwe, and Argandab. And it became a very complex insurgency, which the coalition was unable to fundamentally weaken. If you look at the maps, they're very telling. To note the change in the coalition force presence from even this summer in 2010 to the fall of 2010. And Kandahar was prioritized by the 2010 troop surge, which President Obama had authorized in December of last year. There were nearly two brigades worth of increased forces. And these forces deployed to the critical districts around Kandahar City, where the Taliban ran their networks and controlled much of the population. If you go to the next slide, you'll see a layout of the operations ISAF conducted starting in June of 2010, which continued on through November. These operations were extremely deliberate and took advantage of the increased force presence on the ground to ensure that ISAF could target all of the Taliban strongholds simultaneously and sequentially to prevent the Taliban from simply shifting resources and forces from one front to another. If we go forward two slides, we'll see Argandab district. This is where the coalition's operations began. Argandab was very important for the Taliban. It has some of the densest terrain. It's interesting because in an area that's mostly desert, there are parts of Argandab that look very much like jungle. And the Taliban used these areas to run IED factories where they exported IEDs across the province and into Kandahar City. It was a critical element of their system. It took ISAF some time to clear these areas because the Taliban had built extremely sophisticated IED belts defending their key positions. ISAF started operations at the end of July. By August, had pinned the Taliban in. Throughout August and September, conducted a number of aerial assaults to seize key Taliban facilitation centers and IED factories. And then in early October, breached the Taliban's defensive lines and occupied these villages. Taliban resistance disappeared within the course of several weeks, and coalition forces have now started building tactical infrastructure, have started winning support of the population. The population has been willing to turn in IEDs, cooperate with the coalition, and you've seen a dramatic shift in the course of several weeks in October from Taliban control to coalition control. To go back one slide, we next have Zari and Panjwe districts. These areas were similarly key to the Taliban's operations. Zari district was the home of Mullah Omar. They ran their courts in these districts. Much of the leadership of the Taliban came from these districts, and the Taliban movement started here in 1994. Through the course of September and October, the coalition conducted a number of very deliberate operations to seize the most important to the enemy's command and control nodes, their most important lines of communication and rat lines, and to seize their weapons stockpiles, some of which were very considerable. By the By the middle of October, the enemy resistance had collapsed in much of Zaire, and they were down to a couple of villages, which they held on to through November. In Panjwe to the south, ISAF launched a number of aerial assaults into the last of the Taliban strongholds in mid-October. By the time ISAF forces moved into Panjwe, the Taliban's ability to conduct operations had really collapsed due to the pressure put on them in Argandab and Zaire in the previous months. So by the end of October, by early November, coalition forces controlled what had formerly been the most critical terrain for the Taliban. And this has severely weakened the enemy system. There was a very good article in yesterday's New York Times by Khalada Gal that talked about the extent to which the Taliban had been demoralized. And everything that we've seen from Afghans, and talking to Afghans in Kandahar, suggests this really is the case, that there's been a huge psychological shift. Afghans were extremely impressed by the commitment that coalition forces showed when they came in with a very heavy force presence. It was something that had never been seen before in Kandahar. And the speed with which the Taliban's system collapsed made a deep impression. You have areas in Zaire where in the course of 2 weeks, ISAF went from employing several dozen Afghans in cash for work programs to employing 4,000 to 6,000 Afghans, many of whom had probably been insurgents at one point, but after the insurgency collapsed, were very happy to sort of go with whoever had the momentum, and that meant going with the coalition. Coalition commanders have been very successful in having shuras with the local population, which indicates the Taliban's psychological control of the people is waning. They've been getting more intelligence tips from the population as well. The Taliban will no doubt try to reinfiltrate Kandahar in 2011, but they'll have a very difficult time doing so. Their success in the province through 2009 was due to the complex infrastructure they had built, and that has been denied to them at this point. The coalition is setting up bases in what used to be key Taliban command and control hubs. So the Taliban will find themselves in a significantly weakened position if they try to reinfiltrate the area. And for the first time as well, ISAF, that's the coalition, is committed to actually holding these areas and working with the local population to prevent enemy reinfiltration. So there's several other themes that we could touch on in questions. There's a question of the Afghan National Security Force effectiveness. Kandahar has seen the largest deployment of Afghan security forces in the course of the 9-year war, and this is a major step forward for the Afghan security forces. There are also some governance issues that remain in Kandahar, and that's a big question going forward, whether the coalition can address those, and that will be something that I'd be happy to address in questions. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleague, Jeff Dressler, who will talk on Helmand Province.
So thank you for joining us today. My name is Jeffrey Dressler. Megan Ortega discussed a little bit about my background. I'm focusing today's talk on Helmand Province in particular. I just completed a study on Helmand Province that will be out on Monday, and it really assesses the coalition's progress in Helmand in particular since the summer of 2009 when ISAF initiated really comprehensive counterinsurgency operations in Helmand Province, and I'll talk a little bit about that. What is Helmand? I mean, Helmand basically, prior to the summer of 2009, was a firmly entrenched enemy system from top to bottom, from the south, in the border with Pakistan, all the way up some of the northern districts in Helmand Province. It's also the center of the narcotics Taliban nexus in Afghanistan, which generates millions of dollars in revenue for the Taliban every year. And it's also the place where, ISAF has focused some of their initial efforts in Afghanistan, particularly the UK, who assumed responsibility for Helmand in 2006. The story of Helmand today is much different than it was in the spring of 2009. Today you have a significant force increase in Helmand compared to the spring of 2009, when there were several thousand forces, to today where there are over 30,000 coalition forces, as well as Afghan National Army and police and some special forces elements in the province. And what they've been able to achieve really over the past 18 months is nothing short of remarkable. My paper demonstrates some of the progress that has been made, which will be out on Monday again. But quite frankly, Helmand is unique in Afghanistan, and the reason why, in terms of the counterinsurgency effort, is that it's really the first place that ISAF has executed comprehensive, fully resourced counterinsurgency operations. And you can see sort of the troop increase. If you look at this, the first slide that I have up here demonstrates the increase in forces from the spring of 2009 to today, which is the winter of 2010, the slide the graphic that you see on the right side of the screen. Tremendous force increase. And the reason why this is significant, as I mentioned, not only is it the first place that they're in Afghanistan to have really fully resourced counterinsurgency operations, but it demonstrates, you know, that counterinsurgency can be effective given the right inputs, which is what you see in Helmand. And I think it's pretty remarkable, again, what has been achieved. Really, the recent story of Helmand, the significance of the counterinsurgency operations started in the summer of 2009, when President Barack Obama ordered the troops that President Barack Obama ordered in December arrived in Helmand, some 10,000 Marines, actually, from the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Brigade led by Brigadier General Larry Nicholson, were sent to Helmand Province. And really what they were tasked with doing is securing southern areas of southern and central Helmand prior to the elections, the elections that were taking place. The population was going out to vote in August, and they went in early July. And, you know, you could argue about the significance of the population getting out to vote. Really, what the operations were able to do is they were able to try to sever the enemy system in southern and central Helmand, attempt to push the insurgency back, which by that point was fully entrenched throughout southern and central Helmand, and bring some semblance of security to some of these key population centers in Helmand Province. And what you see now, full 18 months later, is a significant progress in many of those areas, and I'll talk a little bit about that. The insurgency in Helmand is really hurting at this point. There's been a lot of statements recently by senior Marine commanders in Helmand talking about how the insurgency is financially strapped. They're not able to influence the population to the extent that they did back in the spring of 2009. They're increasingly being pushed to the periphery, both to the extreme south and the extreme north, as Marines are continuing their push north. And I'll talk a little bit about sort of what is behind those efforts. But as I mentioned, Strike of the Sword, Operation Strike of the Sword, began in July of 2009, going into the districts of Garmsur and Nawa in southern and central Helmand to try to sever the enemy system that was operating really from south to north, infiltrating from the Pakistan border, and resourcing the insurgency that was active, again, throughout the province. They were really dominating pretty much the entirety of the province, save for a few district centers, but they were able to operate with impunity, you know, and in addition to that, facilitating their narcotics networks throughout the province. So you had operations that began in the summer of 2009, and those continued all the way until the winter of 2010 in February. Marines launched an operation in a district called Marja, which was in central Helmand. And the reason why that is significant is because Marja represented really the stronghold for the Taliban in Helmand Province, both for the narcotics elements, for the production of IDs and weapons, and helped resource the fight really to the south and to the north. It was really the central node of the insurgency in Helmand Province. And quite frankly, it also affected progress in areas to the south, to the south and to the east, where Marines have been operating since the summer of 2009. So it was very important to disrupt and dismantle the Taliban's operations in Marja province, in Marja district, which is what the Marines did in February. And it was it received a tremendous amount of attention. It was all over the news. It was a massive operation on behalf of the Marines. And it was very slow going for a while, simply because of the nature of the terrain in Marja, very lush agricultural areas with canals crisscrossing about the district, very difficult to patrol, very difficult to maneuver. But what you see now since February, you actually are starting to see the first signs of significant progress in Marja. State Department assesses that is in fact the case. And Major General Mills, recently stated that essentially the hard fight in Marja is now over. The insurgency has been routed. They've been able to keep the insurgency from reinfiltrating the district. And so that's actually significant progress. Right now, what you're seeing is Marine operations have been consolidated in southern and central Helmand, and they're starting to build on the gains that have been achieved over the past 18 months. both in security and the establishment of effective district governance with the help of a very effective provincial governor in Governor Mongo, who works very well with the coalition, is very supportive of his district governors. The issue with Governor Mongo is more the fact that he is not an ally of President Karzai. President Karzai has not been tremendously supportive of Governor Mongo, primarily because he supports another individual who was basically driven from his governorship by the British, by the UK efforts when they came into to the province in 2006. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. If we go all the way to the end of the slides, what you can see here is basically a graphic showing the enemy disposition in the province from the spring of 2009 all the way up until current. And what you see is actually significant progress. The enemy currently still maintains sanctuary outside the province in Baluchistan, in Pakistan, Baluchistan. But within the province, there's been significant progress. The southern portion of the province is no longer able to support operations both in the south, in the center, and the north. It's been dismantled. It's been disrupted. The insurgency really cannot mount an effective counteroffensive to try to destabilize the Marines' efforts both in security and in Afghan governance. They're very limited in terms of what they can actually do in terms of kinetic activity against the Marines, but also even really coming in at night and intimidating the population is having extremely limited effects and is not nearly as effectual as it was in Marja shortly after the operations there. What the Marines are now doing is they're starting to push north, and you can see that the north is still a Taliban stronghold. They have safe haven up in some of the northern districts. There's a tremendous amount of kinetic activity. The Marines have essentially taken over for the UK in the northern reaches of the province, who have basically drawn back and consolidated in some of the central districts where they're operating. And the Marines have now taken over responsibility. And so what they're finding is a tremendous fight up there. It's really the last, as I mentioned, the last sanctuary, the last safe haven for the Taliban in Helmand province. This area up in northeastern Helmand, on the border with Kandahar, is part of the larger southern Afghanistan enemy system. It affects the security efforts that are ongoing in Kandahar province, so it's very important to get after that. But it's also the center of the narcotics elements in Helmand province that were driven from Marja. And so the Marines are basically pushing up north. As I mentioned, they've taken over for the UK there, and right now they're essentially trying to push from Sangin district in the north up to Kajaki through Route 611 to try to get to the Kajaki Dam to secure the dam. The dam is in the dam facility. Some of the turbines that are operating there supply electricity for northern and central Helmand, but also for parts of Kandahar as well. And so they're trying to get there so they can install a third turbine that was actually delivered a few years ago. And they haven't been able to install it because they simply can't get the supplies there given the perilous security situation on the road. And so the Marines are currently trying to do that. There's a few other issues, though, aside from the security situation that I mentioned has tremendously improved over the past 18 months. The Afghan National Security Forces in Helmand, operating in Helmand, have also improved significantly. The Army, in particular, is a relatively new corps, 215th Corps, that was stood up in the spring. And they're actually the spring of 2010. They're having tremendous progress given where they were during some of the initial operations that they participated in the summer of 2009 compared to where they're at today. The partnering is critical. The partnering has increased. The Marines are actively partnering on patrols, and increasingly the Afghan National Army is able to actually take over responsibility for some areas in a few key districts. In Nawa district in particular, which is in central Helmand, part of the 2009 Strike with the Sword operation, Marines have essentially turned over control of the security situation in the central areas and some of the key patrol bases throughout the district, and are moving to the perimeter and sort of an overwatch role so that the Afghans can operate independently. And so that's been a significant improvement. Also, the Marines have basically instituted their own training effort in Camp Leatherneck, which is their base in Helmand province, and that's also been very significant. As you may know, the training of Afghan security forces is done on a national level, but the Marines have sort of taken it upon themselves to build capacity at the local levels as well, including recruiting, training, and that's having a significant effect as well. The poppy problem, narcotics in Helmand is a significant issue. It's probably one of the areas where we haven't made as much progress as folks would like. It's a very difficult situation with many factors. But what I will say is that the effort to interdict narcotics in Helmand, which is basically going after traffickers, going after stockpiles, going after refineries, has been tremendously successful. They've been able to uncover a tremendous amount of drugs, chemicals, and increasingly what we're seeing is that this stuff is co-located with IEDs, with homemade explosives, and so what that really represents is sort of a joining of the narcotics and the Taliban elements, increasingly so over the last several years, but we're also seeing the Taliban really taking more control over the narcotics trade in Helmand province. They're involved in all aspects of the business now, from collection, encouraging farmers to grow, to processing and refining, and then trafficking. And so it allows them to sort of, maximize their profits. There's also a sort of an alternative livelihoods project that has been underway for several years, essentially trying to get farmers to switch from illicit to licit crops. And there's been some successes with that, but one of the things that concerns me is that program over the next year has been pegged to scale back. And that's particularly problematic, number one, because the farmers are sort of, relying upon this to help them make the shift. They've been promised this, and now it's being scaled back. And one of the things about moving from illicit to licit crops is that it really is a several-year process. You can't expect that from one year to the next, everything is going to be taken care of. They need support. They need materials such as seeds and fertilizer. And previously, the food zone program in Helmand has provided that, but, concerns about it being scaled back, I think, really threatens to jeopardize some of the gains that have been made on the counter-narcotics and alternative livelihood front over the past several years. One of the other things that I think is key, which my colleague Carl discussed in Kandahar, is the governance issue. As I mentioned, Governor Mongo is a tremendously supportive governor. He's respected by the majority of the population. He's not a corrupt individual, and he's taken a very proactive role in governance issues in Helmand Province. But there's another individual who was formerly the governor of Helmand Province who was removed after a cache of opium was discovered in his basement several years ago. Is still influential in the province. And this individual, Sher Muhammad Akhundzada, is actually an ally of President Karzai. What I talk about in the paper, which will be out again on Monday, is sort of the links and the relationship between these individuals and that it continues today. But the reason why this is problematic is because Sher Muhammad Akhundzada is negatively influencing developments in the province. He wants to come back to power. President Karzai thus far has signaled, at least in part, that he's supportive of that. And Akhundzada, along with his some individuals who are aligned with him, are negatively impacting the situation. They're not supportive of Governor Mongo. They have intervened on several occasions in district governance efforts that have helped to destabilize a few districts in particular. And so this continues today, and I talk about this more thoroughly, obviously, in the paper, but I think it's an important thing to flag because, as much as the Marines make progress and the UK efforts make progress and the Afghan National Security Forces, and we move forward on governance, reconstruction, development, and counter-narcotics, I think the issue of negative influencers from the national and from the provincial level in Helmand could, threaten to jeopardize some of the progress that has been made. So it's very important to address that in really the most effective way. I'll just close with a recent study that was released by the Washington Post, ABC, and the BBC. And from December 2009, the population they were heartened by some of the progress that was made, but the gains had not been solidified yet. Now we're starting to see that. The number of individuals in Helmand who rated their security as good increased 14% since December of 2009 to 67% as of December 2010. Two-thirds of Helmand residents believe that Afghanistan is on the right track. 71% describe their living conditions as good, which is also an increase of 27% since late last year. And of those surveyed, 59% give positive marks to the availability of jobs, which is, again, up 50% from last year, which is a tremendous increase. And also the public assessments of the availability of clean water and medical care, which is a significant concern, are sharply higher than last year. And so that's sort of an indicator of how the population feels about this. Again, you know, we can talk until we're blue in the face about progress of counterinsurgency operations, but ultimately this is about the population. And so I think that demonstrates that the population is supportive of what we're doing and some of the gains that we've seen there. I will close with that. I'd be happy to take questions, and I'll turn it back over to Megan.
All right. Chris is going to offer a few instructions for those who would like to ask a question. And if you could, whenever it's your turn, please say your name and the organization that you represent or your affiliation.
If you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. This will place your question in the order it was received. Again, if you would like to ask a question or have a comment, press star 1 on your telephone keypad now.
All right, and while everyone's taking a chance to line up in the queue to ask questions, I'm going to take moderator's prerogative and ask you guys the first question. And really this is for Jeff or Carl, since I know, Carl, you're undertaking a new study on the north, and, Jeff, you obviously have studied the east a lot. One of the complaints about the efforts in Helmand and Kandahar is, yes, we have seen demonstrable progress. The enemy really does seem to be beaten back in these provinces, but the argument is that they've moved on to places in the north and the east where they're finding new safe zones, new places to hide out. Did the command expect this? Did they not? Should we be concerned? Should we not? And how much of a problem is it?
Well, thanks, Megan. Afghanistan is such a large country that inevitably you're not going to be able to do counterinsurgency across the entire country. So it is very much an issue of prioritizing certain areas, deciding what areas have strategic effects on the rest of the country. And that's what we've done, particularly with Kandahar. There's some debate occasionally whether Helmand is quite as important as Kandahar. I think it has some importance because it does tackle the entire enemy system across the south. I think the biggest question when we ask, you know, what areas are important is the importance of the east, which does have some significance, especially because areas of it can be used, and Jeff can address this at greater length, areas can be used to move into to Kabul. But the command certainly did expect that they weren't going to destroy, you know, the Taliban across the country within the space of several years. I think they expected that the Taliban would move to other areas. And they went about prioritizing the south because of its strategic importance, because that's key to the Taliban's attempt to paint themselves as a legitimate government. That is their heartland. If they're driven out of the south, they're not a viable force going forward. And of course, when you're talking about where the Taliban have gone to, there's always the Pakistan question as well. And it's true that the Taliban are using Pakistan to reconstitute at this point. And so that will be a consistent concern. But nevertheless, if you can make progress in Kandahar and the Taliban are relegated to being based in peripheral areas and in Pakistan, it's hard to win an insurgency when you're based in a foreign country and you don't actually have a presence on the ground. So there are limits for the Taliban if they decide to go with the strategy of simply withdrawing into safe areas, withdrawing into Pakistan. Eventually they'll fade as a relevant force in Afghan politics.
Yeah, I think Carl makes some very good points. I would just add to that, you know, of course the insurgency can relocate, but the fundamental issue here is that southern Afghanistan was really their central location. It was their base. It's where they originated. But it's also it's really key to them in terms of support, in terms of their firmly entrenched support system and enemy network, which Carl certainly described in Kandahar. They no longer have that. So the impact on the enemy has been profound. The command prioritized southern Afghanistan in particular for this very reason, and what we see now is the enemy is increasingly being squeezed out of there, and they're forced to relocate to other areas where, you know, is not a tremendous Pashtun population, is not their typical base of support, and quite frankly, they're hurting because of it. And so you know, that's what you have to do in a situation where you have to prioritize areas because you don't have as many resources as you'd like. That's always going to be the case. Afghanistan in particular presents tremendous challenges, both because of the size of the province and the complexity of the terrain. But southern Afghanistan was prioritized, and from where we are now versus where we were throughout southern Afghanistan in the spring of 2009 has been tremendous progress, and the enemy is certainly feeling the effects of that.
All right. Chris, I'll turn it over to you to let the first caller ask a question.
All right. Let's go with our first question in the queue. Caller, go ahead with your question, please. All right. We'll go with our next question then.
Well, can I? Oh. It's confusing. Well.
Go ahead.
I'm Tom Parker from OSD Policy. Can I ask a question? It's not clear what the Q thing is. So.
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, here's the question. Can you comment a little more extensively on the quality of the Afghan army units that you saw in Helmand and also in Kandahar, and any comments on Razak and his forces?
Hey, Dr. Parker, good to have you on the call.
Hi, thank you.
This is Jeff Dressler. I'll just touch on the Helmand thing briefly, and then I'll let Carl tackle the Kandahar issue. The quality of the ANA units has improved tremendously from where they were, really in 2009. During the initial operations, Strike of the Sword, in July of 2009, General Nicholson did not have as many Afghan units as he would like. They were sort of cobbled together from various other corps. As I mentioned, the 215th Corps is sort of a new creation. And so what the Marines have tried to do is partner very closely with these units, monitor their progress, and really sort of train them in the field rather than just the training that they receive in the military bases in Kabul and in Helmand. And so that's really where they're going to progress in terms of learning how to interact with the population. And skills in patrolling and, you know, all the other tasks that come along with being in the Afghan National Army. It has improved significantly. The partnering has increased. In Operation Mostarak in February of 2010, there were some problems with ANA performance in the field. Individuals refused to patrol. They refused to get out of their trucks where it was warm. They refused to help to supply some of their neighboring units that were operating in Marja. Since then, I think there's been some significant progress. The Marines report that the ANA is really quite effectual compared to where they were. Now, General Mills reports that they're able to execute small independent operations, including operating in enemy-controlled territory for days, even without coalition artillery or logistical support. Over the summer, in particular, they planned, they led, and they supported their own operation in the central district of Nari Siraj, which is really something we haven't seen before. So, again, the close partnering, the training, the mentoring, and as the Corps matures, I think you're going to see this continue. So that's just a little bit of the Army in Helmand, and I'll turn it over to Carl.
Well, to start with the Afghan National Army in Kandahar, you've got two brigades operating in Kandahar right now. One is the 1st Brigade, which is one of the more distinguished units in the ANA. It's been around for a number of years and performed with a fair amount of independence initiative in Kandahar over the course of this year. The second unit is the 3rd Brigade of the 205th Corps of the ANA, which was a very recently generated corps, one of the products of the accelerated NTMA training process in Kabul, which has now really picked up the pace. But this unit is, I think, one of the interesting test cases on the effectiveness of this sort of more in mass production, rapid training that's going on right now. The initial reports from some of the units in this brigade were somewhat negative in Kandahar, but frankly, very negative in areas. This is a unit where even the officer corps was more or less new. NCO corps was new or hardly existed. The enlisted guys were all completely new. And the question is here, I think, not so much what the quality of the unit was when it first deployed to Kandahar, but whether it is improving. The coalition is committed to partnering throughout Afghanistan. Jeff touched on that. but partnering can serve as a more effective form of training than basic training far within the battlefield in Kabul. And you look at the example of Iraq, partnering with very new Iraqi security forces and the coalition was a very effective way to build a strong Afghan army. So I think the critical test, we know the unit started off being extremely raw, not very effective, but the critical test is whether operations in Kandahar will also improve the quality of the Afghan army, or whether there are some concerns that you've had some units which there's been significant attrition that's slowed down recently because of some measures taken, but we'll have to look at what comes of these units and if they become more effective. Dr. Parker also touched on the question of Razik. Abdul Razik is technically the commander of the Afghan border police in Spin Buldak district, which is on the Pakistan-Kandahar border. But he's also a very prominent power broker, runs his own significant tribal business networks, accused of narcotics involvement, essentially runs Spin Buldak as his own independent fiefdom, an extremely controversial figure. Most of his strongest units are those coming from his own tribe. And there are some trade-offs in using him, and the coalition has deployed him for multiple operations in the course of Hamkari. He brings a certain local knowledge to the fight. His unit is probably one of the most effective in the entire Afghan National Security Forces because of these sort of strong personal loyalties that come from using a tribal militia. And so it's been very effective in combat and very effective in securing Spin Buldak District. But there are trade-offs because there are also long-term problems with using figures like this. There's a broader question of who owns the government in Kandahar. Is it owned by a very small clique of power brokers, people like Ahmadwali Karzai, whose name has also come up very frequently recently, Ahmadwali Karzai and his allies like Razik. And this is one of the huge concerns in Kandahar, that the government is very exclusive. Most Afghans in Kandahar question its legitimacy, question whether a government run by a small number of tribes and power brokers is really a legitimate government. And figures like Razik have also been accused of significant crimes in the past, which they've not been punished for. So there are these important trade-offs. Ultimately, you do have to convince the population the government is more than just a collection of power brokers and militia commanders. And so using Razik does pose long-term challenges, and I think ISAF will have to seriously address this question going forward.
Thank you.
All right. Next question.
Sure, and let's take our next question from the queue. Caller, go ahead with your question, please. All right, let's try the next one.
Hi, Dale Erickson from the Center for Complex Operations. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to moving away a little bit from the maneuver force and the kinetic aspect of the fight, and maybe speak a little bit to the level of integration by the maneuver forces, both Afghan and coalition, with the development aspect of it, the district support framework, and maybe even the village support operations on the soft side, the level of integration and effectiveness or non-effectiveness?
Well, I can start with that, talking about what's occurred in Kandahar. In Kandahar, you have a pretty sophisticated civilian governance strategy, actually, that was formed in consultation between the Regional Command South, ISAF headquarters, and then the Regional Civilian Platform, which is a U.S. State Department platform, and then the Canadian U.S. Provincial Reconstruction Team. And this was also done in consultation with Kandahar Governor Toyala Wesa. So the governance and development strategy was very much an integrated strategy that involved input from the military and the civilian actors and the Afghan government in Kandahar province. The civilian surge has allowed the coalition to put a number of district support teams in the critical districts around Kandahar City. We have small teams of U.S. civilians who go and live with and mentor the district governor, And that's an effective way to have some eyes on the ground at the district level when it comes to governance and development questions. And those teams are tied extremely closely to the military battalions in the districts. The integration is very good. The military, of course, ends up doing a lot of the reconstruction because of its CERT budget, because it has the boots on the ground. But those efforts have been very closely linked not only with U.S. and Canadian civilians, but also with the Afghan government. And the governor ultimately had an integral role in designing the civilian strategy in Kandahar. You also asked about integration with the village stability operations being done by special forces. There are several of those in Kandahar. One of the very first Afghan local police programs was in Argandab district, when they gathered together a group of village guardians selected by village elders who would serve as a sort of informal defense force in some of the more stable areas of Argandab. And in Argandab district, that program worked very well, and it's also been closely tied to the battle space owners, to the battalion that's there. And the battle space, the battalion commanders are also getting involved in trying to win support from local villages. You have two programs. You have the Afghan Local Police, which is the Special Forces program, and the battalion commanders are also working on a program called Sons of the Shura, which forms community watch programs. So these efforts are very integrated. You have some incidents here and there where you've got less integrated efforts. In northern Kandahar, for example, you have a small team in Kakra's district, which is really not tied in at all. That's a small special forces team, not very well tied into the rest of the effort, but that's a somewhat isolated incident. And in central Kandahar, the level of cooperation has been extremely close between special forces, U.S. Army, the Canadian teams, and the civilian effort and the Afghan government.
Dale, it's Jeff Dressler. I'm going to talk a little bit about Hellman to address your question, which is an excellent one. The integration is key. A lot of the Marines that I talk to in researching my paper talk about how, at a district level, the partnering of the battalion commander and the district governor is extremely close and extremely important. They work very, very closely together to help. And in many cases, you're standing up district governance where it really previously did not exist, or at least not in an effectual way. And so what you're doing is you have, Carl touched on, district support teams. You have groups of individuals with various skills from economics to, governance to development who come out and work with the district governor, help him recruit and train a staff, help pay the staff, but there's also another key element of district governance, which is community councils, which is really a selection of some of the influential figures in the district, tribal leaders and whatnot. And these are the individuals that really consult with the district governor to help figure out, what projects to tackle, how to spend the money, what the population really cares about. And so it's the relationship between the community council and the district governor, and his staff that is also key. And actually what we see in many cases, in many districts in Hellman, where the Marines have been operating really for the past 18 months, is that working very well. Now a district is extremely advanced. Marja, you're seeing, after replacing the previous district governor, you're seeing progress in Marja on the governance front. One of the challenges that the Marines talk about is local capacity, trying to identify capable civil servants. One of the issues with that is simply an issue of pay. If you have a literate Pashtun in southern Afghanistan, he's going to work as an interpreter, making in some cases as much as over $2,000 over $2,000 per week, which is pretty significant. If you look at the district governor's salary, in some cases it's around $80 a week. So that's a tremendous disparity. And so what that means is that the talented individuals, the ones who are literate, the ones who can communicate well, who know the area, are going to take the job as the interpreter. And so the Marines, it's a significant challenge. They've tried to work on that with a civil service academy and some of these other things, and so that remains to be a challenge. I'll just talk a little bit about the local police issue that Carl touched on. Marines do things a little bit differently in Helmand Province. One issue I'll highlight in particular sort of demonstrates the success of these local defense initiatives. In Marja District in particular, there's an individual who was a former Mujahideen commander. He basically stood up his own force in the village of Dutanau in Marja, And this individual has hundreds of locally recruited people who have come to help police the village, to keep the Taliban out. And what you're seeing is a tremendous development push and reconstruction push in that village in particular, because these individuals have secured it, and it's safe for the PRT, the Provincial Reconstruction Team, to go in and do these things. And it's having such a tremendous effect that the other villages are now looking at this and trying to figure out how they can create their own force. Now, of course, the challenge with that is that you want to make sure that those individuals are not using their force to achieve their own ends, whether that's going to be, you know, invading a neighboring district or settling scores, or even, you know, dominating the poppy trade. So that's the thing that the Marines will have to keep a close eye on. But the fact is that what you now have is villagers standing up for district governance, for keeping the Taliban out, and it's been a tremendous force multiplier, particularly in Helmand Province.
All right, and let's move on to our next question.
Yes, this is John Doyle with the 4G War Blog. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay, great. In the declassified overview that we got to see yesterday of the Afghan report, there's several mentions of sanctuaries or across the border in Pakistan, and the danger they pose to meeting the final goals of dismantling the insurgency and al-Qaeda. And I was surprised to see in your map that there is a sanctuary located in across the border in Baluchistan at the borders of both Helmand and Kandahar province. And I'd always been led to believe that most of these sanctuaries were in the Northwest Territories and the tribal areas much farther north and to the east. So my question is, whose sanctuary is that? Is that al-Qaeda or Taliban, and is it Pashtun or Baluchi, or does that even make a difference? Then finally, how much of a threat is that sanctuary to what's going on in Helmand and Kandahar provinces?
This is Jeff Dressler. I'll try to tackle that as best I can. I think it's an excellent point. I think it's really the you know, one of the first and foremost concerns going forward in Afghanistan. You're not wrong about the sanctuary issues in the Pakistan border. Really, in the east in particular, where you have a sanctuary that is protected by elements within the Pakistani security establishment in North Waziristan, focusing on some of the east and the southeastern areas of Afghanistan. But in the south, you know, you do have sanctuary across the border. And from what we've seen, you know, the Pakistani army and frontier corps' ability to deal with that has really not developed, whether it's a question of will or capacity. You know, you can kind of take your pick. I think it's a little bit of both. But quite frankly, you know, you have sanctuary across the border. And I'll just talk about Helmand Province in particular, because I think this is a very key issue. Across the border in Baluchistan, there is a refugee camp there. There's a town on the border called Baram Shah that is really the key hub for Taliban infiltration into Helmand Province. The Marines are increasingly trying to push out towards that bazaar from the Afghan side, but there's no complementary effort on the Pakistani side, and so. You know, they do have the ability to recruit, train, facilitate homemade explosives and all of that from the Pakistani side of the border. And quite frankly, the Pakistani security forces have not done as much as they could with this issue. Now, whether or not that threatens to jeopardize, you know, all progress in Afghanistan or people say, you know, we can't win if we don't get at these sanctuaries, I don't know that I would go that far. I think, you know, despite these sanctuaries in Helmand Province, you're seeing significant progress, and that's enduring progress. That's not something that can be undermined in a matter of weeks or months. So it is an issue. I think you know, where that is the biggest issue is in the east and the southeast, as you mentioned, and the Pakistani security forces' protection of those sanctuaries to support their proxy forces in Afghanistan. And I'm sure Carl can talk about that a little bit more and how that applies to Kandahar. But yes, you do have a sanctuary issue. It's a very negative influencer on security and progress, and quite frankly, I think it's something that we need to do a better job learning how to engage the Pakistanis on this through a variety of means.
Yeah, and there's similar Taliban command and control hubs just across the border in Kandahar. So it doesn't entirely show up on the map you have in front of you. But across the border from Spinball, there's a town of Chaman on the Pakistani side, which is also a very important Taliban command and control node for the entirety of Kandahar province. So, I mean, just to zoom out, I think if you look at Afghanistan, you could say there are three critical issues which we're facing. One is the military question against the Taliban. The second is the governance issue. The Afghan government is weak, does not have the support of the population. The security forces at this point, they have some time before they're going to be ready to secure their own country. And the third issue is the Pakistan safe haven. I think you could say that if the coalition solves two of the three problems, that's probably enough. So even if sanctuary remains in Pakistan, if you can solve the governance issue and defeat the enemy in Afghanistan itself, that will prevent sanctuaries in Pakistan from being of any significance. But it's true that the sanctuaries in Pakistan do impose a higher standard to some extent on the coalition. If we do have to leave behind a government that can secure itself, that has popular support, that has effective security forces, given that there always will be the risk of insurgent networks that can regenerate across the border.
All right, and then on to our next one.
Hi, this is Lieutenant Bouchard. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right. I'm with 3rd Brigade, 10th Mountain Division, and based on the destruction of the Taliban network and safe havens in Kandahar province specifically over the course of 2010, what do you think the enemy's most likely course of action is going to be in 2011? So if we had these networks and safe havens in Panjwani and Argandab to influence what's going on in Kandahar City, do you expect the Taliban to attempt to rebuild those networks or bypass it and focus specifically on Kandahar City? And do you think they're going to try to, undermine Afghan forces in particular or go after civilians to retain that fear factor?
That's a great question, Lieutenant. They definitely will attempt to reinfiltrate central Kandahar. There's very little doubt about that. It's key terrain for them. They need to do that to maintain their status. I think some lessons for what will happen, if you look back to previous places across southern Afghanistan where the Taliban were cleared out and then had to reinfiltrate in the face of a large coalition presence, that would probably serve as a decent template. So looking at what happened in Marja over the summer, for example, might be useful. The Taliban will avoid direct confrontations, especially at this point, given that their attack networks have been dismantled. They will focus on intimidating the population. That's what we've seen in the past in places where the Taliban, face a very large, overwhelming coalition presence. So that will involve things like assassinations. They continue their assassination campaign in Kandahar City. And it's possible that the Taliban will try to use pockets of Kandahar City for sanctuary, given that there are still areas of the city where there's a smaller coalition presence. Their attempt will be to intimidate the population, and to the extent the population will no longer be willing to communicate with the coalition. If the Taliban can do that, it will help them maybe run a very low-grade IED campaign. That will be more difficult for them than it has been in the past to use an IED campaign. However, they'll probably place greater priority on the northern districts of Kandahar, given that those areas have a smaller coalition force presence. Maiwand district might be very important going forward. But I think it will mostly focus on a campaign to intimidate the population and to create a perception of, as much as they can, create a perception of violence against the coalition while not actually conducting the sophisticated attacks they've conducted over the past several years. So it will be occasional sporadic firefights, occasional sporadic IED attacks.
Yeah, Lieutenant, it's Jeff Dressler. I know Helman's not your AO, but there's a couple issues that I think I can highlight that have applicability really across provincial lines. Number one is the intimidation thing. I mean, what we're seeing in Helmand is that the Taliban's intimidation attempts are really not paying off for them anymore. And, it's fine when the population doesn't have anybody to turn to and there's no security, and it's quite easy for the Taliban to intimidate the population. What we're seeing as security increases and as Afghan governance increases on the district level, and you know, development and assistance comes in, the population does not respond well to Taliban intimidation. They don't like it, and it really is not able to achieve its desired effect that the Taliban is trying to achieve, which of course is to prevent cooperation with ISAF and legitimate Afghan governments. And so that's one thing. It wears thin. In Helmand Province, they simply will not be able to mount a sustained counteroffensive. They've been squeezed north. They really don't have anywhere to operate from in southern and central Helmand. And as you know, with military operations, you need to have a base of support. You need to be able to project force forward. They don't have that anymore. And so they're getting pushed north, and that's a bad thing for the enemy. The other thing is that, you know, aside from intimidation, they also look for things that they can exploit. Number one, which comes to mind immediately for Helmand Province, is the poppy trade. They come in and they'll protect. They'll encourage farmers to plant poppy. Then they'll offer protection to protect their fields from Afghan eradication efforts. And then they'll actually pick up the poppy from the farm and pay the farmers for it at that point. And so the poppy thing it creates an opportunity for the Taliban to expand their influence. And so it's going to be very careful to watch that over the course of the coming year.
All right. We have actually reached the end of our time on this conference call. If you had a question and you did not get an opportunity to ask it, please feel free to email me and I'll get you in touch with either Jeff or Carl or both and try to get your question answered. I'd like to thank Jeff and Carl for doing an excellent job. I think this presentation was really enlightening, and hopefully everyone on the call enjoyed it as much as I did. And thank you for listening, and we encourage you again to stay in touch with ISW. Please check out our website, understandingwar.org, and thanks very much.
Thank you, and that will conclude our call for the day.